Chapter 12. "Do you know what a pony is, Lady Guinevere?" he asked. Her ladyship said yes. As he had a cream-colored one at Castle Barbican, and stared when Lord Martingale announced that he should soon have 1,000 ponies, worth £5 and £20 each, which were all now kept at Coutts. Then he explained the circumstances of the bet with Bagnigg. Parliament was to adjourn in 10 days. The season would be over. Bagnigg was lying ill chez lui, and the £5 and £20,000 were irrecoverably his. And he vowed he would buy Lord Binnacle's yacht, crew, captain, guns and all. On returning home that night from Lady Polkemore's, Martingale found among the many billets upon the gold plateau in his antechamber the following brief one, which made him start. "Dear Martingale, don't be too sure of Binnacle's yacht. There are still 10 days before the season is over, and my ponies may lie at Coutts for some time to come. Yours, Bagnigg. P.S. I write with my left hand, for my right is still splintered up from that confounded fall. 3. The tall footman, number 4, who had come in the place of John, cashiered, for want of proper mullets, and because his hair did not take powder well, had given great satisfaction to the under-butler, who reported well of him to his chief, who had mentioned his name with praise to the house steward. He was so good-looking and well-spoken a young man that the ladies in the housekeeper's room deigned to notice him more than once, nor was his popularity diminished on account of a quarrel in which he engaged with Monsieur Anatole, the enormous Walloon chasseur, who was one day found embracing Miss Flouncy, who waited on Amethyst's own maid. The very instant Miss Flouncy saw Mr. Jeames entering the servants' hall, where Monsieur Anatole was engaged in gravating her, Miss Flouncy screamed. At the next moment the Belgian giant lay sprawling upon the carpet, and Jeames, standing over him, assumed so terrible a look that the chasseur declined any further combat. The victory was made known to the house steward himself, who, being a little partial to Miss Flouncy herself, complimented Jeames on his valor, and poured out a glass of Madeira in his own room. Who was Jeames? He had come recommended by the Bagnigg people. He had lived, he said, in that family 2 years. At where there was no ladies, he said, a gentleman's age, and was spoiled for service. And Jeames was a very delicate hand. Miss Flouncy admired it very much, and of course he did not defile it by menial service. He had in a young man who called him sir, and did all the coarse work, and Jeames read the morning paper to the ladies, not spellingly and with hesitation, as many gentlemen do, but easily and elegantly, speaking off the longest words without a moment's difficulty. He could speak French too, Miss Flouncy found, who was studying it under Mademoiselle Grandville de Chambre de Confiance, for when she said to him, "Parlez-vous Francie, Monsieur Jeames?" he replied readily, "Oui, mademoiselle, je passe beaucoup de temps à Paris. Comment vous parlez-vous?" How Miss Flouncy admired him as he stood before her, the day after he had saved Miss Amethyst, when the horses had run away with her in the park. Poor Flouncy, poor Flouncy! Jeames had been but a week in Amethyst's service, and already the gentle heart of the washing girl was irrecoverably gone. Poor Flouncy! Poor Flouncy! He thought not of thee. It happened thus. Miss Amethyst being engaged to drive with her cousin the prince in his phaeton, her own carriage was sent into the park simply with her companion, who had charge of her little Fido, the dearest little spaniel in the world. Jeames and Frederick were behind the carriage with their long sticks and neat dark liveries. The horses were worth 1,000 guineas each, the coachman a late lieutenant colonel of cavalry. The whole ring could not boast a more elegant turnout. The prince drove his curricle, and had charge of his bell cousin. It may have been the red fezes in the carriage of the Turkish ambassador which frightened the prince's greys, or Mrs. Champignon's new yellow liveries, which were flaunting in the park, or hideous Lady Gorgon's preternatural ugliness, who passed in a low pony carriage at the time, or the prince's own want of skill. Finally, but certain it is that the horses took fright, dashed wildly along the mile, scattered equipages, pietons, dandies' caps, and snobs' phaetons. Amethyst was screaming, and the prince, deadly pale, had lost all presence of mind, as the curricle came rushing by the spot where Miss Amethyst's carriage stood. "I'm blessed," Frederick exclaimed to his companion, "if it ain't the prince a driven our missus. They'll be in the Sir Pinkton, or dashed to pieces, if they don't mind." And the runaway steeds at this instant came upon them as a whirlwind. But if those steeds ran at a whirlwind pace, James was swifter. To jump from behind, to bound after the rocking, reeling curricle, to jump into it, aided by the long stick which he carried, and used as a leaping pole, and to seize the reins out of the hands of the miserable Borodino, who shrieked piteously as the dauntless valet leapt on his toes and into his seat, was the work of an instant. In a few minutes the mad, swaying rush of the horses was reduced to a swift but steady gallop, presently into a canter, then a trot, until finally they pulled up smoking and trembling, but quite quiet, by the side of Amethyst's carriage, which came up at a rapid pace. "Give me the reins, Malapris, two Mecrises Lacour, Maynant," yelled the frantic nobleman, writhing underneath the intrepid charioteer. "Tant piss poor toy, nigod," was the reply. The lovely Amethyst of course had fainted, but she recovered as she was placed in her carriage, and rewarded her preserver with a celestial smile. The rage, the fury, the maledictions of Borodino, as he saw the latter a liveried menial stoop gracefully forward, and kiss Amethyst's hand, may be imagined rather than described. But James heeded not his curses. Having placed his adored mistress in the carriage, he calmly resumed his station behind. Passion or danger seemed to have no impression upon that pale marble face. Borodino went home furious, nor was his rage diminished, when, on coming to dinner that day, a re-church banquet served in the frangipane best style, and requesting a supply of a puree a la biscox ecrevices, the clumsy attendant who served him let fall the assiette of vermeil sisal, with its scalding contents, over the prince's chin, his Mechlin jabot, and the grand cordon of the Legion of Honor which he wore. "Infam," howled Borodino, "two laws fate experts." "Ow, gee law I fate experts," said the man, with the most perfect Parisian accent. It was James. Such insolence of course could not be passed unnoticed even after the morning service, and he was chast on the spot. He had been but a week in the house. The next month the newspapers contained a paragraph which may possibly elucidate the above mystery, and to the following effect. Singular wager. One night, at the end of last season, the young and eccentric Earl of BGNG laid a wager of £25,000 with a broken sporting patrician, the dashing Marquis of MRTNGLA, that he would pass a week under the roof of a celebrated and lovely young heiress, who lives not a 100 miles from BLGRV Scourie. The bet having been made, the Earl pretended an illness, and having taken lessons from one of his lordship's own footmen, Mr. James Plush, whose name he also borrowed, in the mysteries of the profession, apostrophe actually succeeded in making an entry into Miss P. Milliliter's Co's mansion, where he stopped 1 week exactly, having time to win his bet, and to save the life of the lady, whom we hear he is about to lead to the altar. He disarmed the Prince of Borodino in a duel fought on Calais Sands, and, it is said, appeared at the Sea Club wearing his plush costume under a cloak, and displaying it as a proof that he had won his wager. Such, indeed, were the circumstances. The young couple have not more than 900,000 a year, but they live cheerfully, and manage to do good. And Emily de Pentonville, who adores her daughter-in-law and her little grandchildren, is blessed in seeing her darling son Enfin on home range. Crinoline. By G. M. S. P. L. S. H. Esk. I'm not at liberty to divulge the real names of the two heroes of the Extrani tale which I am about to relate to those enlightened patrons of literature and true connoisseurs of merit the great British public, but I pledge my veracity that this singular story of romantic love, absorbing passion, and likewise of genteel life, is, in the main facts, true. The circumstances I allude to occurred in the reign of our present gracious majesty and her beloved and royal consort Prince Albert. Wilton. Sometime in the season of 18 more I dare not reveal, there arrived in this metropolis, per second class of the London and Dover Railway, an elegant young foreign gentleman, whom I shall denominate Monsieur Jules de Chacabac. Having read through the Vicar of Wakefield in the same original English tongue in which this very article I write is wrote to, and always been remarkable, both at college and in the Estaminet, for his hatred and horror of perfidious Albion, Monsieur Jules was considered by the proprietors of the newspaper in which he wrote, at Paris, the very man to come to this country, examine its manners and customs, cast an eye upon the political and financial state of the emperor, and expose the machinations of the infamous Palmerston and the abominable Sir Pill, both enemies of France, as is every other Briton of that great, glorious, liberal, and peaceable country. In one word, Jules de Chacabac was a penny a liner. I will go see with my own eyes, he said, that infamous island of which the inhabitants are shopkeepers, gorged with roast beef and treason. I will go and see the murderers of the Irish, the poisoners of the Chinese, the villains who put the emperor to death in Saint-Tilly, the artful dodges who wish to smother Europe with their cotton, and can't sleep or rest easy for envy and hatred of the great invincible French nation. I will examine, face to face, these haughty insularies. I will penetrate into the secrets of their Jesuitical cabinet, and beard Palmerston in his den. When he jumped on shore at Folkestone after having been tremendously sick in the fur cabin, he exclaimed, Enfin GT teens, I'll maudite, GT crache la figure, vieil angleter, GT foule mespits and nom du monde outrage, and so proceeded to invade the metropolis. As he wished to mix with the very chicest society, and get the best of information about this country, Monsieur Jules of course went, and lodged in Leicester Square, as he calls it, which, as he was informed in the printed circular presented to him by a very greasy, but polite commissioner at the customs stairs, was in the center of the town, contiguous to the Houses of Parliament, the principal theatres, the parks, St. James Palace, and the courts of law. Concern we them all at one cut of the eye, Jules thought. The sovereign, the infamous ministers plotting the destruction of my immortal country, the business and pleasure of these puspered Londoners and aristocracy. I can look round and see all. So he took a three-pair back in a French hotel, the Hôtel de Lille, kept by Monsieur Gigotet, Cranbourne Street, Leicester Square, London. In this hotel there's a billiard room on the first floor, and a table d'hôte at 18 pence paired at 5 o'clock, and the landlord, who came into Jules' room smoking a cigar, told the young gent that the house was frequented by all the British nobility, who regular took their dinners there. Hey, can they bite their own cuisine, he said. We'll see what a dinner we'll serve you today. Jules wrote off to his paper the members of the haughty and luxurious English aristocracy, like all the rest of the world, are obliged to fly to France for the indulgence of their luxuries. The nobles of England, quitting their homes, their wives, milady's and mistress, so fair but so cold, dine universally at the tavern. That from which I write is frequented by Peel and Palmerston. I premise to think that I may meet them at the board today. Singular to say, Peel and Palmerston didn't dine at the Hôtel de Lille on that evening. 'Tis quite extraordinary they don't come, said Monsieur de Lille. Perhaps they're engaged at some boxing match or some combat de coq, Monsieur Jules suggested, and the landlord agreed that was very likely. Instead of English there was, however, plenty of foreign society, of every nation under the sun. Most of the noblemen were great amateurs of ale and porter. The tablecloth was marked over with brown suckles, made by the pewter pots on that and the previous days. It is the usage here, wrote Jules to his newspaper, among the Angles of the fashion, to absorb immense quantities of ale and porter during their meals. These stupefying, but cheap, and not unpalatable liquors are served in shining pewter vessels. A mug of foaming Afanoff, so a certain sort of beer is called, was placed by the side of most of the convives. I was disappointed of seeing Sir Peel. He was engaged to a combat of cocks which occurs at Windsor. Not one word of English was spoke during this dinner, except when the gentleman said, "Arsong de Afanoff," but Jewel was very much pleased to meet the elite of the foreigners in town, and asked their opinion about the real state of things. Was it likely that the bishops were to be turned out of the Chamber des Communes? Was it true that Lord Palmerston had boxed with Lord Brougham in the House of Lords, until they were separated by the Lord Mayor? Who was the Lord Mayor? Wasn't he Premier Minister? And wasn't the Archivicta Canterbury a Quaker? He got answers to these questions from the various gents round about during the dinner which, he remarked, was very much like a French dinner, only dirtier. And he wrote off all the information he got to his newspaper. The Lord Mayor, Lord Lansdowne, is Premier Minister. His Grace has his dwelling in the city. The Archbishop of Canterbury is not turned Quaker, as some people stated. Quakers may not marry, nor sit in the Chamber of Peers. The minor bishops have seats in the House of Commons, where they are attacked by the bitter pleasantries of Lord Brougham. A boxer is in the house. He taught Palmerston the science of the pugilate, who conferred upon him the seat, and see his writing cover. Jules came down and had a game at pool with two Poles, a Belgian, and two of his own countrymen. This being done amidst more Afanoff, without which nothing is done in England, and as there was no French play that night, he and the two French gents walked round and round Leicester Square smoking cigars in the faces of other French gents who were smoking too. And they talked about the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.